In other news.
You know, the towers did not burn up. They turned into powder in midair.
That's scary to have this helicopter hovering around.
We walk up to him and confront him. They can't stand that.
Welcome to Another News. I'm Jeff Brady. We hear presentations by three individuals on various elements regarding the engineered pandemic, and begin with Dr. David Martin, who addressed the European Parliament at the International COVID Summit in May 2023. Dr. Martin unwaveringly explains how a step-by-step premeditated process was implemented to weaponize this pathogen. By 2017, the media would repeat the warning, quote, intentional or accidental release of a respiratory pathogen after it was known this chimera could be used. It's odd how this warning was issued, and in this context, Dr. Thomas Cowan's ideas of new viruses formed in the body from exposure to a quantum leap in background radiation, such as third, fourth, and fifth generation micromillimeter wave exposure, is still on the table. What is also interesting is that North Carolina Health Secretary Dr. Mandy Cohen was nominated as the next CDC director. The lab where the gain-of-function research was conducted is located in Chapel Hill. Dr. Martin is the founding chairman of MCAM Asset Management Company, and he's an American patent auditing expert. Let's hear this presentation.
It is a particularly interesting location for me to be sitting today, given that over a decade ago, I sat in this very chair right here in the European Union Parliament. And at that time, I warned the world of what was coming. During that conversation that was hosted at the time by the Green and EFA and a number of the other parties of the European Union's various representations, we were having a conversation on whether Europe should adopt the United States policy of allowing for the patents on biologically derived materials. And at the time, I urged this body and I urged people around the world that the weaponization of nature against humanity had dire consequences. My role today is to set the stage for this conversation in a historical context, because this did not come in the last 3 years. This did not come in the last 5 or 6 years. This actually is an ongoing question that probably began here in Europe in the early stages of the mid-1900s, but certainly by 1913, 1914, this conversation started right here in Central Europe. The pandemic that we alleged to have happened in the last few years also did not happen overnight. In fact, the very specific pandemic using coronavirus began in a very different time. Most of you don't know that coronavirus as a model of a pathogen was isolated in 1965. Coronavirus was identified in 1965 as one of the first infectious replicatable viral models that could be used to modify a series of other experiences of the human condition. It was isolated once upon a time associated with the common cold. But what's particularly interesting about its isolation in 1965 was that it was immediately identified as a pathogen that could be used and modified for a whole host of reasons. And you heard me correctly, that was 1965. And by the way, these slides are public domain. You're welcome to look at every single reference. Every comment that I made is based on published material. So do make sure that you look at those references. But in 1966, the very first COV coronavirus model was used as a transatlantic biological experiment in human manipulation. And you heard the date, 1966. I hope you're getting the point of what I'm saying. This is not an overnight thing. This is actually something that's been long in the making. A year before I was born, we had the first transatlantic coronavirus data sharing experiment between the United States and the United Kingdom. And in 1967, the year I was born, we did the first human trials on inoculating people with modified coronavirus. Isn't that amazing? 56 years ago, the overnight success of a pathogen that's been 56 years in engineering. And I want that to chill with all of you. Where were we when we actually allowed, in violation of biological and chemical weapons treaties, where were we as a human civilization when we thought it was an acceptable thing to do to take a pathogen for the United States and infect the world with it? Where was that conversation? And what should have been that conversation in 1967? That conversation wasn't had. Ironically, the common cold was turned into a chimera in the 1970s. And in 1975, 1976, and 1977, we started figuring out how to modify coronavirus by putting it into different animals, pigs and dogs. And not surprisingly, by the time we got to 1990, we found out that coronavirus as an infectious agent was an industrial problem for two primary industries, the industries of dogs and pigs. Dog breeders and pigs found that coronavirus created gastrointestinal problems, and that became the basis for Pfizer's first spike protein vaccine patent filed, are you ready for this, in 1990. Did you hear what I just said? 1990. Operation Warp Speed? I'm sorry. Where's the warp and the speed? Pfizer, 1990, the very first spike protein vaccine for coronavirus. Isn't that fascinating? Isn't it fascinating that we were told that, well, the spike protein is a new thing. We just found out that that's the problem. No. As a matter of fact, we didn't just find out it was not just now the problem. We found that out in 1990 and filed the first patents on vaccines in 1990 for the spike protein of coronavirus. And who would have thought? Pfizer. Clearly the innocent organization that does nothing but promote human health. Clearly Pfizer. The organization that has not bought the votes in this chamber and in every chamber of every government around the world. Not that Pfizer. Certainly, they wouldn't have had anything to do with this. But, oh, yes, they did. And in 1990, they found out that there was a problem with vaccines. They didn't work. You know why they didn't work? It turns out that coronavirus is a very malleable model. It transforms and it changes and it mutates over time. As a matter of fact, every publication on vaccines for coronavirus from 1990 until 2018, every single publication concluded that coronavirus escapes the vaccine impulse because it modifies and mutates too quickly for vaccines to be effective. And since 1990 to 2018, that is the published science, ladies and gentlemen. That's following the science. Following the science is their own indictment of their own programs that said it doesn't work. And there are thousands of publications to that effect, not a few hundred. And not paid for by pharmaceutical companies. These are publications that are independent scientific research that shows unequivocally, including efforts of the chimera modifications made by Ralph Baric and the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. All of them show vaccines do not work on coronavirus. That's the science. And that science has never been disputed. But then we had an interesting development in 2002. And this date is most important. Because in 2002, the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, patented, and I quote, an infectious replication defective clone of coronavirus. Listen to those words, infectious replication defective. What does that phrase actually mean? For those of you not familiar with language, Let me unpack it for you. Infectious replication defective means a weapon. It means something meant to target an individual, but not have collateral damage to other individuals. That's what infectious replication defective means. And that patent was filed in 2002 on work funded by NIAID's Anthony Fauci from 1999 to 2002. And that work, patented at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, mysteriously preceded SARS 1.0 by a year. Dave, are you suggesting that SARS 1.0 wasn't from a wet market in Wuhan? Are you suggesting it might have come from a laboratory in the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill? No, I'm not suggesting it. I'm telling you that's the facts. We engineered SARS. SARS is not a naturally occurring phenomenon. The naturally occurring phenomenon is called the common cold. It's called influenza-like illness. It's called gastroenteritis. That's the naturally occurring coronavirus. SARS is the research developed by humans weaponizing a life system model to actually attack human beings. And they patented it in 2002. And in 2003, giant surprise, the CDC filed the patent on coronavirus isolated from humans in violation, once again, of biological and chemical weapons treaties and laws that we have in the United States. And I'm very, very precise on this. The United States likes to talk about its rights and everything else and the rule of law and all the nonsense that we like to talk about. But we don't ratify treaties about, I don't know, defending humans. We conspicuously avoid that. We actually have a great track record of advocating for human rights and then denying them when it comes to actually being part of the international community, which is a slightly problematic thing. But let's get something very clear. When the CDC in April of 2003 filed the patent on SARS coronavirus isolated from humans, what did they do? They downloaded a sequence from China and filed a patent on it in the United States. Any of you familiar with biological and chemical weapons treaties knows that's a violation. That's a crime. That's not an innocent oops. That's a crime. And the United States Patent Office went as far as to reject that patent application on two occasions until the CDC decided to bribe the Patent Office to override the patent examiner to ultimately issue the patent in 2007 on SARS coronavirus. But let's not let that get away from us, because it turns out that the RT-PCR, which was the test that we allegedly were going to use to identify the risks associated with coronavirus, was actually identified as a bioterrorism threat by me in the European Union-sponsored events in 2002 and 2003, 20 years ago. That happened here in Brussels and across Europe. In 2005, this particular pathogen was specifically labeled as a bioterrorism and bioweapon platform technology. Described as such, that's not my terminology that I'm applying to it. It was actually described as a bioweapons platform technology in 2005. And from 2005 onwards, it was actually a biowarfare enabling agent, its official classification from 2005 forward. I don't know if that sounds like public health to you. Does it? Biological warfare enabling technology. That feels like not public health. That feels like not medicine. That feels like a weapon designed to take out humanity. That's what it feels like. And it feels like that because that's exactly what it is. We have been lured into believing that EcoHealth Alliance and DARPA and all of these organizations are what we should be pointing to. But we've been specifically requested to ignore the facts that over $10 billion have been funneled through black operations through the check of Anthony Fauci and a side-by-side ledger where NIAID has a balance sheet and next to it is a biodefense balance sheet equivalent dollar-for-dollar matching that no one in the media talks about. And it's been going on since 2005. Our gain-of-function moratorium, the moratorium that was supposed to freeze any efforts to do gain-of-function research. Conveniently, in the fall of 2014, the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, received a letter from NIAID saying that while the gain-of-function moratorium on coronavirus in vivo should be suspended, because their grants had already been funded, they received an exemption. Did you hear what I just said? A biological weapons lab facility at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, received an exemption from the gain-of-function moratorium so that by 2016, we could publish the journal article that said, SARS coronavirus is poised for human emergence in 2016. And what, you might ask, Dave, was the coronavirus poised for human emergence? It was WIV1, Wuhan Institute of Virology Virus 1, poised for human emergence in 2016 at the proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, such that by the time we get to 2017 and 2018, the following phrase entered into common parlance among the community. There is going to be an accidental or intentional release of a respiratory pathogen. The operative word, obviously, in that phrase, the word release. Does that sound like leak? Does that sound like a bat and a pangolin went into a bar in the Wuhan market and hung out and had sex, and lo and behold, we got SARS-CoV-2? No. Accidental or intentional release of a respiratory pathogen was the terminology used, and four times in April of 2019, 7 months before the allegation of patient number one, four patent applications of Moderna were modified to include the term accidental or intentional release of a respiratory pathogen as the justification for making a vaccine for a thing that did not exist. Keep going. If you have not done so, please make sure that you make reference in every investigation to the premeditation nature of this, because it was in September of 2019 that the world was informed that we were going to have an accidental or intentional release of a respiratory pathogen so that by September 2020, there would be a worldwide acceptance of a universal vaccine template. That's their words right in front of you on the screen. The intent was to get the world to accept a universal vaccine template, and the intent was to use coronavirus to get there. Let's read this, because we have to read this into the record everywhere I go. Until an infectious disease crisis is very real, present, and at the emergency threshold, it is often largely ignored. To sustain the funding base beyond the crisis, he said, we need to increase the public understanding for the need for medical countermeasures such as a pan-influenza or pan-coronavirus vaccine. A key driver is the media, and the economics will follow the hype. We need to use that hype to our advantage to get to the real issues. Investors will respond if they see profit at the end of the process. Sounds like public health? Sounds like the best of humanity? No, ladies and gentlemen, this was premeditated domestic terrorism stated at the proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences in 2015, published in front of them. This is an act of biological and chemical warfare perpetrated on the human race, and it was admitted to in writing that this was a financial heist and a financial fraud. Investors will follow if they see profit at the end of the process. Let me conclude by making five very brief recommendations. The last slide. Nature was hijacked. This whole story started in 1965 when we decided to hijack a natural model and decide to start manipulating it. Science was hijacked when the only questions that could be asked were questions authorized under the patent protection of the CDC, the FDA, the NIH, and their equivalent organizations around the world. We didn't have independent science. We had hijacked science. And unfortunately, there was no moral oversight in violation of all of the codes that we stand for. There was no independent, financially disinterested, independent review board ever impaneled around coronavirus. Not once. Not once. Not since 1965. We do not have a single independent IRB ever impaneled. around coronavirus. So morality was suspended for medical countermeasures. And ultimately, humanity was lost because we decided to allow it to happen. Our job today is to say no more gain-of-function research, period. No more weaponization of nature, period. And most importantly, no more corporate patronage of science for their own self-interest unless they assume 100% product liability for every injury and every death that they maintain. Thank you very much.
That was Dr. David Martin speaking at the European Parliament at the International COVID Summit in May of 2023. We now hear another important presentation about your fundamental rights when it comes to any agency issuing a mandate to take an injection. Author and human rights activist Barbara Lowe Fisher is co-founder and president of the nonprofit National Vaccine Information Center. This presentation is titled, Forced Vaccination Was Always the End Game. Well, it certainly supports the in-depth research on premeditation evidence Dr. David Martin presented. Let's have a listen.
With the exception of Pearl Harbor and September 11, 2001, Americans have not been attacked by an enemy on our own soil. Unlike countries in Europe during World War II, America has never been occupied by a military force or locked down under martial law. We have never seen soldiers in armored vehicles patrolling the streets, warning us to stay in our homes or face arrest or worse. Beginning in 1776, when our freedom-seeking founders wrote the Declaration of Independence and stood their ground from Lexington and Concord to Saratoga and Valley Forge, and then came together to create a constitutional republic dedicated to protecting individual and minority rights, the United States of America has defined and served as a beacon for liberty for people around the world. This summer, we watched soldiers patrolling the streets of Sydney, Australia, with helicopters overhead, blaring warnings to a stunned, locked-down people to stay in their homes in the name of the public health. We have watched hundreds of thousands of people, young and old, gather together again and again in the streets of Paris, London, Rome, Athens, and Berlin. They are marching against authoritarianism, the kind of Orwellian authoritarianism embodied in government-issued vaccine passports that punish citizens for simply defending the right to make a voluntary medical decision for themselves and their minor children, a decision about whether to be injected with a biological pharmaceutical product that can cause serious reactions, injure, kill, or fail to work. The signs they carry say, no forced testing, no forced vaccines. Stop the dictatorship. Hands off our children. My body is mine. Big Pharma shackles freedom. No to the passive shame. Better to die free than live as a slave. In what has become a prophetic primal scream for liberty, governments are ordering the police to break up the largely peaceful demonstrators flooding the big cities and small villages of Western Europe. The first populations to organize massive public protests against old-fashioned tyranny dressed up in 21st century clothes. The people of Europe were the first to stand up for freedom during this government-declared public health emergency because they know how tyranny begins. They know what it looks like, and they remember what it feels like. They remember and are declaring, never again. Most Americans living today do not remember World War II, or if they do, it is through what their parents or grandparents told them about it. World War II was not fought on American soil. Americans went to war in Europe to stop the slaughter of millions at the hands of an authoritarian fascist government commanding the army of the Third Reich that killed in the name of the public health and safety, even as an authoritarian communist government slaughtered many more millions during a reign of terror in the Soviet Union. Most American children today are not taught what happened in China after World War II, when the Chinese Communist Party implemented the Great Leap Forward and the Great Proletarian Cultural Revolution. Those militant ideological cleansing campaigns imprisoned and killed tens of millions of citizens because they criticized or opposed authoritarian government policies. In America, we have taken our freedom for granted, because while we have been willing to fight to defend the freedom of others, we have never been called upon to defend it in our own backyard. Most Americans have never imagined we would experience a serious threat to autonomy and freedom of thought, speech, conscience, and assembly. So deep has been our trust in the laws and cultural values, which have, for the most part, ensured fundamental freedoms in our country, that we never believed it could happen here. But the last 20 months have changed everything. Many Americans have begun to understand that tyranny can be disguised to look like safety, even as many others still cannot bring themselves to believe it. Striking fear into the hearts and minds of the people, the move toward authoritarianism in America began with government officials suddenly telling us, even children as young as 2 years old, that we could not breathe fresh air or enter public spaces without a mask covering our face. Millions of American workers, judged to be non-essential, lost the ability to earn a living so they could eat and pay rent during flatten-the-curve lockdowns we were told would last only a few weeks, but instead went on for months. Anyone who criticized government narratives about the origin of SARS-CoV-2 virus or questioned social distancing restrictions was immediately publicly shamed and censored. Any doctor who tried to provide early treatment for COVID-19 patients by repurposing safe and effective licensed drugs and nutritional supplements to help their patients survive the infection were also publicly shamed and censored. After the FDA granted Pfizer and Moderna an emergency use authorization in December 2020 to distribute their liability-free experimental mRNA COVID-19 vaccines in the U.S., public health officials enlisted big corporations to launch a hard-sell national vaccine advertising campaign targeting all Americans over the age of 12. Anyone who asked questions or challenged the hard sell was immediately censored on social media. State governments and employers were encouraged to threaten workers, especially healthcare workers and emergency responders, with loss of their jobs for refusing the vaccine. Private businesses were encouraged to deny unvaccinated citizens entry to restaurants, stores, and other public venues. By the end of July 2021, the Department of Veterans Affairs directed all VA healthcare workers to be fully vaccinated or lose their jobs. In early August, the Department of Defense announced that all military service members must be fully vaccinated when the FDA officially licenses a COVID-19 vaccine or lose their jobs. Suddenly, on August 23, the Pfizer mRNA vaccine was licensed without a public meeting of the FDA Vaccines and Related Biological Products Advisory Committee and full disclosure of the scientific data supporting licensure. By the end of August, about 176 million Americans had been fully vaccinated, representing a 53.6% of our population of 333 million people, which is the third largest in the world. And studies had confirmed that the SARS-CoV-2 infection mortality ratio in the U.S. remains at less than 1%. But the executive branch of the U.S. government was not happy. Federal health officials had publicly set the goal of persuading 90% of Americans to get the COVID vaccine, although it is clear now that the real goal all along was a 100% vaccination rate. No exceptions and no questions asked. At the beginning of September, the politics of persuasion gave way to an iron-fisted approach, using the heel of the boot of the state to try to club 100 million unvaccinated Americans into submission. On September 9, 2021, the President of the United States followed the advice of top public health officials and, in effect, declared war on unvaccinated Americans. He's scapegoated and placed all the blame for the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic on the unvaccinated, even though federal health officials admit that fully vaccinated people can still get infected and transmit the virus to others. And even though breakthrough COVID infections, hospitalizations, and deaths in fully vaccinated people are on the rise. And even though evidence shows individuals who have recovered from the infection have stronger natural immunity than those who have been vaccinated. And even though officials at the World Health Organization now say that the SARS-CoV-2 virus is mutating like influenza and is likely to become prevalent in every country, no matter how high the vaccination rate. The president told 100 million unvaccinated Americans that, quote, our patience is running thin, and issued an executive order that every person working for the executive branch of the federal government, more than 2 million people, must get fully vaccinated or lose their jobs. That order also applied to about 17 million healthcare professionals working in medical facilities that accept Medicare and Medicaid. There is no option for executive branch employees to get tested. The rule is get vaccinated or be fired. It is interesting that the order does not apply to workers in the judicial branch or legislative branch, which includes members and staffers in Congress. The president also ordered the Department of Labor to issue a rule that carries penalties of $14,000 per violation to force private companies with more than 100 employees to get their workers fully vaccinated or be tested weekly. He also called for all teachers and school staff in all schools to be fully vaccinated. The next day, the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, Dr. Anthony Fauci, criticized the president for not going far enough. Fauci said that the government should give Americans no option but to get injected with the biological product that some describe as a vaccine, others characterize as a genetic therapy or cell disruptor biological, and others allege is a bioweapon made in a lab in China with U.S. funding. Then Fauci said all children must be vaccinated or denied a school education, and all unvaccinated people must be banned from getting on an airplane. At the same time, a Virginia congressman introduced the Safety Travel Act that would require travelers getting on a plane or Amtrak train in the U.S. to show proof of COVID vaccination or a negative COVID test within 72 hours of boarding. Today, people in some cities are being denied entrance to restaurants and stores if they can't prove they have been fully vaccinated. Doctors are refusing to provide medical care to the unvaccinated. Hollywood entertainers are celebrating the deaths of unvaccinated people, saying they deserve to die, and are calling for the unvaccinated who get COVID to be denied admission to hospitals for treatment. Judges are separating children from mothers who have not gotten a COVID shot. Influential scientists are insisting lawmakers make it a hate crime for anyone to publicly criticize scientists and government health officials. Dissenters are told they are selfish and characterized as an enemy of the state for simply defending the human right to informed consent to medical risk-taking. The normalizing of the ritualistic persecution of Americans who are refusing to give up the right to autonomy, which is the first and most fundamental human right, is underway. The Orwellian message is, the life of any person who dissents from government policy must be systematically destroyed. Demanding obedience, government health officials characterized public health policies that segregate, discriminate, and turn people against each other as the good. Yet a lot of Americans instinctively know segregation and discrimination is not good. They know that persuading a majority of citizens to scapegoat a minority of citizens to cover up the failures of government is allowing evil to triumph. Dissenting Americans, both vaccinated and unvaccinated, fill the ranks of every socioeconomic class, every political party, and every faith-based community. They understand the meaning of the warning that, quote, the only thing necessary for triumph of evil is for good men to do nothing. And they are not going to stand by and do nothing. When government threatens to take away an individual's right to employment, education, health care, and the ability to enter a store to buy food, enter a hospital, or travel on public transportation, there is no other word for it but tyranny. This virus, which has a 99% survival rate, and this leaky vaccine, which fails to reliably prevent infection and transmission in the fully vaccinated, has racked up a record-breaking more than 500,000 vaccine adverse event reports in the U.S. alone. It will not be the last virus and vaccine to be weaponized against the people in the name of the greater good. That is because forced vaccination is the tip of the spear in a culture war that has been going on for much longer than the 40 years that I have been a vaccine safety and human rights activist, publicly warning that this day would come. It is a war that will cause more suffering until enough of us refuse to be siloed and instead join together to change dangerous laws that abuse the trust and goodwill of the people. Every single American, whether you have been vaccinated or not, should stop to reflect upon what is happening in our country. Think about what liberty means. Imagine what life will be like in the future if you cannot leave your home without being harnessed to a government-issued digital ID, which contains personal information about your body and your life, and is hooked up to an electronic surveillance system that records and controls every move you make. Imagine if you are a healthcare worker and your medical license is taken from you for refusing to get a government-mandated vaccine, which is a public health policy being implemented in Washington, D.C., a city where doctors can now vaccinate children as young as 11 years old without the knowledge or consent of their parents. Imagine if you cannot hold any type of job or enter a grocery store to buy food to feed your family, or enter a drugstore, cafe, gym, school, cinema, museum, park, or beach without showing proof you've been vaccinated. Imagine if you are denied entrance to a doctor's office or lose your Medicare and Social Security benefits because you don't have the vaccine passport, a suggestion made recently on national television. Imagine if you cannot get on a plane or bus to visit your children or elderly parents because federal government officials have exercised authority over interstate commerce and banned the unvaccinated from crossing state borders, an action that some proponents of forced vaccination are urging the current administration to make. Forced vaccination was always the end game, both before and during this pandemic, and the proof of that lies in the decades of federal legislation and federal agency rulemaking, paving the way for what we are experiencing today. Right now, forced vaccination is the quickest means to what the World Economic Forum transparently describes on its website as the Great Reset. You, your children and grandchildren are the commodity. And in the name of the greater good, you are expected to obediently allow others to reset your life in all kinds of ways without making a sound. The government-issued passport allowing you to function in society is just the first step on the slippery slope to what will be many more requirements and restrictions on your freedom in the days, months, and years to come. The question is, will you allow yourself to be used and abused by those currently holding the power to do what they want to do to you? Or will you defend your God-given right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness? This pandemic of deception and incompetence has stolen from our daily lives the peace and joy we deserve to have, leaving too many of us confused and paralyzed by fear, divided from our family and friends, crippled with anxiety and despair, allowing hopelessness to rule our days. It doesn't have to be like this. We can refuse to be psychologically manipulated so we are stripped of love and compassion and are unable to engage in rational thinking. We can push back against the authoritarians taking away our freedom and trying to divide us. We can do it the way that all successful social reform movements before us have done it, through actively participating in local, state, and federal government, and by engaging in non-violent civil disobedience if that becomes necessary. Instead of allowing ourselves to be separated from one another, we can stay connected and meet together in small groups in our homes and neighborhoods. We can develop personal relationships with our elected officials at every level of government, from our local sheriff and elected members of local school boards and city and county councils to our elected state and federal legislators. If we don't like the way the people we have elected are governing, we can vote them out or run for office ourselves and help change the laws. We can talk to the young men and women serving in our community police departments and the U.S. military to remind them of how important it is to value and protect human rights and civil liberties, so that if they are ever called upon to implement authoritarian rule, they will make the right choice. Above all, we can be self-disciplined and make rational decisions that do not lead to violent confrontations, because that kind of behavior only plays into the hands of those whose ultimate goal is to take away autonomy and more individual freedoms in the United States. During the civil rights movement of the 1950s and 60s, the most profound statements were made by those who sat down in the front of the bus or in a chair at a segregated restaurant or other public place and simply refused to move. There are restaurant owners in New York City who are refusing to follow orders directing them to discriminate against and deny service to the unvaccinated. There are veteran healthcare workers on the front lines caring for patients during the pandemic who are being fired for supporting informed consent rights and giving up their careers to stand on principle. Many of them suspect that the next cruel order they will be told to obey is to deny life-saving medical treatment to unvaccinated patients. There are corporate CEOs and union leaders who are refusing to bow to political pressure to require rank-and-file workers to get the vaccine or risk losing their jobs. There are courageous doctors and scientists who have never spoken out publicly before, who are risking their careers by demanding that mass vaccination policies be backed up by good science, who are challenging the government's narrative that natural immunity is not as good as vaccine-acquired immunity, who are criticizing the long-term safety of mRNA vaccines and providing convincing evidence that the SARS-CoV-2 virus did not spontaneously jump out of a bat, but was genetically engineered by scientists in biohazard labs. There are state lawmakers who are listening to the people and refusing to vote for the passage of forced vaccination laws that perpetuate the illusion that vaccine passports are the only solution to ending the pandemic. These Americans are rejecting authoritarianism. They are heroes, and they are on the right side of history. They and many other brave Americans are helping us make our way through this time of fear, oppression, and suffering, when the cultural values and beliefs that have guaranteed freedom in this great country of ours are being tested. I believe we will come together and pass this test. We will act responsibly to protect our liberty. We will restore the spirit of freedom to its rightful place at the center of our culture. We will do it because we know that if the state can tag, track down, and force individuals against their will to be injected with biologicals of known and unknown toxicity today, then there will be no limit on which individual freedoms the state can take away in the name of the greater good tomorrow. You can choose to be a hero wherever you live. You can choose to reject the ugly call to shame and punish your friends, family members, neighbors, colleagues, and fellow citizens for defending the human right to autonomy and protection of bodily integrity, which is the essence of the informed consent ethic. You can choose freedom over fear. Be the one who never has to say, you did not do today what you could have done to change tomorrow. Do it for yourself, your children and grandchildren, and for all the generations to come. It's your health, your family, your choice. And our mission continues. No forced vaccination, not in America.
That was a presentation by Barbara Lowe Fisher, a co-founder and president of the nonprofit National Vaccine Information Center. That presentation was titled, Forced Vaccination Was Always the End Game. We now hear part of a fiery speech from Dr. Naomi Wolf, speaking out against mandatory bivalent booster shots for Yale College students. This was back in December of 2022. Let's hear part of that speech.
I'm here as a Yale alumna. I'm here as a mom. I'm here as someone who has always believed in the promises of my alma mater, whose motto is Lux et Veritas, light and truth. And what that is supposed to mean is that people have the right to ask questions, and they have the right to know what is real, and they have the right, above all, to what a liberal arts education is supposed to provide, which is discerning liberty of thought, freedom of expression, and informed consent. I cannot believe, like, I'm literally speaking here, but my heart is breaking and I'm on the verge of tears, because I cannot believe that in the year 2022, after 35 years of advocacy for women's health and human rights and civil liberties, I'm standing here to say Yale University should not mandate 17-year-olds, 18-year-olds, 19-year-olds, 20-year-olds, 21-year-olds with an experimental, dangerous mRNA lipid nanoparticle injection just so they can come back to school and resume their educations. I can't believe I have to say this, but here we are, and these young people who don't deserve to even have to think about this endangerment of their future, this crushing of their spirits just to get the education that many of their parents have slaved for and saved for years, and that they worked so hard to obtain. I am here to tell Yale University, I used to live just beyond there when I was a freshman. I lived at Davenport and then Berkeley when I was an undergraduate. I believed that this place would protect the civilization that it sought to portray, right? A civilization in which I learned about the Nuremberg Code here at Yale. I learned about the Geneva Conventions here at Yale. I learned about the Hippocratic Oath and Galen and the great tradition of medical illumination here at Yale University. I cannot believe I'm standing outside these walls saying, don't coerce children and young adults, minors and young adults, into damaging their lives and submitting to an illegal injection that violates the Geneva Conventions, that violates the Nuremberg Code, that violates the Hippocratic Oath, that violates basic human rights, so these kids can pick up their education. Don't do it. And I want to talk about the legalities now, or rather the crimes that Yale is about to commit. I want to tell the world, if it hasn't been following, that Yale University doesn't mandate the faculty for this bivalent booster. Yale University doesn't mandate the staff for this experimental injection. It is mandating the children. It is mandating the kids, the students. So, say that again.
Coercion is not consent.
Exactly right. Now, I want to tell Yale, I'm speaking to the university now. I'm speaking to any representatives of the university. I'm speaking to any undercover security police of the university. What you're about to do is a serious crime. It is deeply illegal. Certainly, it violates Title IX. Now, this university receives federal funds, millions of dollars in federal funds. There have been Title IX lawsuits before in my time. There was a major settlement because they violated Title IX. Title IX commits the university to not discriminate on the basis of sex or gender in getting an equal education. I am telling Yale, I oversee a project in which 3,500 experts review the Pfizer documents released under court order by a lawsuit. In that document, there is catastrophic harm to women, and especially to young women, and especially to their reproductive health. There, in the Pfizer documents, there are 20 different names for f***ing up your menstrual cycle. I am not kidding, and pardon my language, but I am angry. As a woman, there are 20 different ways you can bleed all month. You can bleed twice a month. You can bleed in such a way that you're hemorrhaging. You can bleed so that you've got agonizing cramps. And if that, and 72% of those with adverse events in the Pfizer documents are women. Is that a violation of Title IX to inflict that on the class of 2023, 2024, 2025? Yes. It is a violation. How will these young women pursue their education equally if they're suffering? How will they be athletes? How will they pursue their athletic scholarships if they're injured in that way? Now, something else you have to know, and I'm telling Yale, because that means they can't pretend in the litigation that they didn't know. I'm putting them on notice that there is a drop of 20% in births around the world among vaccinated populations, and that in the Pfizer documents, 80% of the pregnancies that were followed resulted in miscarriage. And then the VARS database, there are more miscarriages for vaccinated women than from all the vaccines for the entire history of the VARS database to date. So these young women, I've had my babies. Right? Women my age have had our babies if we aren't going to be moms. These young women haven't had their children yet. What are you doing to them? What are you inflicting on them? You're violating them. For sure. For sure there will be 18, 19, 20, 20-year-old members of the class of 2023, 2024, 2025 who will not be able to conceive. And we know it. From seeing the Pfizer documents. We know it. It's a fact. It's a fact. For sure, there are going to be women who will be injured reproductively for the rest of their lives. Dr. James Thorpe has shown how the lipid nanoparticles traverse the placenta and damage the placenta, resulting in higher rates of miscarriage, spontaneous abortion, and stillbirths. When that happens, where will Yale be? Right? That'll happen a few years from now. Where will Yale be? Yale will have blood on its hands from those young women it injured for no medical reason. Why get a booster at this point at all for healthy young populations? The data are in. The CDC backtracked. They confirmed what I've been telling you for a year and a half. Vaccines don't affect transmission. So there's literally no reason for anyone to mandate any injection for a respiratory virus of this kind. Now let's talk about the young men. And I know I'm getting close to being done with my time. The young men, we know now, Yale, we know now. This injection causes higher rates of cardiac damage to healthy young men. We know it. It is not a secret. It is confirmed. Multiple studies from around the world. VARS data, the CDC confirmed that this injection causes heart damage to young men. That heart damage is not brief or mild. Once you have myocarditis, your life is impaired forever. And in many cases, your life is shortened. What is that going to do to all these young men who came here just to get an education, who will be weak, who will have health bills they can't pay, who will not be able to compete athletically or to pursue their dreams. And where will Yale, or died suddenly, exactly, where will Yale be? It's a litigation-free injection. But what we're seeing, why is Yale doing this? What we're seeing is that the universities took the money. I haven't found the paper trail for Yale. I haven't looked, but I will bet you, why would they do such a crazy, damaging, destructive, cruel, sadistic thing to their own student population? I will bet they took the money, whether it's CARES Act money or Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation money, the money that basically the third crime I want to mention, trafficking. There's Title IX, there's violation of the Nuremberg Code, there's also trafficking. Basically, Yale is using the bodies of its students by trafficking them to take the money, right? They're exploiting the bodies of students for money. And this is also a crime, a major crime. I believe it's a felony. I think it's also battery. I looked up the code for Connecticut, and I believe that it's battery and coercion. So these are a bunch of crimes Yale's about to inflict on the returning class after winter break. And I think there's going to be a massive wave of lawsuits. But above all, I want to speak to whoever has a conscience. I hope they're there on the board or in the president's office, but especially among the alumni. And the reason there are not dozens of parents here, I can tell you why. It's not that the parents aren't terrified and angry. It's because their kids have begged them not to stand up and speak out, right? So you guys, I'm proposing a major action going forward. We at Yale, we parents will speak up for the Yale kids, and the Yale parents speak up for the Cornell kids, and the Cornell parents speak up for the Princeton kids, and the Princeton parents speak up for the SUNY kids, and the SUNY parents speak up for, you know, all the rest of the kids in every state in the union that is still trafficking in young adults' bodies. And this is the only way we're going to stop this, because there are lawyers among the Yale parents, right? There are lawyers among the Cornell and Princeton parents, and these lawyers have to take action on behalf of other people's children so that their own children do not have to live in fear. Thank you. Thank you.
That was Dr. Naomi Wolf giving a presentation at Yale University in New Haven, Connecticut. That's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. Visit inothernewsradio.com for archives and more information about the guests.